All right, Michelle. Well, let's cheer up and do Fargo. We'll do it in Barkley's memory, in his honor.
Okay.
So, Michelle, I'm looking through. This is West Coast Project, and we're here to do the Fargo podcast. And I was looking for the palindrome. Did you ever find the palindrome?
You know, I didn't. I kept trying to figure out exactly what they were talking about, and I'm not sure that I did. Did you?
No, I'm even looking through Seppenwall, and he comes up with some good ones. Like, of course, a palindrome is something you can say forward and backwards, and same thing.
Right.
Race car. Well, I guess race car isn't one. Race car is something else. But Madam, I'm Adam is one. Or Mom. Or here's a cool one. A man, a plan, a canal, Panama. Say that backwards, and it's the same thing.
Yeah, I feel like we should have been able to find something on this, but I couldn't. I don't know.
Well, Seppenwall says, not to steal his thunder, but many of the players we met over the course of the season of Fargo don't seem particularly palindromic. They start as one thing and end as something else entirely, and their journey looks radically different when viewed start to finish rather than finish to start. And then he says, except for Lou. Lou is palindromic in character, if not in name. He's the same at the tail's end as he was at the beginning. As he will be 7 years into the future.
Yeah, he kind of is. I thought he opened up a little bit in this episode, though. I thought he showed maybe a little bit more of, I don't know, the 70s Lou.
Yeah, but he was the same. You know, he didn't get a 70s look about him. I mean, he didn't get like 90s look about him. He always looked the same.
Well,
he was Lou through and through. But let's bust away from Seppenwall, Michelle, do our own damn podcast here.
Okay, let's do it.
So I thought about something about last week. A lot of people panned to last week because of the spaceship. Didn't like it at all. Thought it jumped the shark. The series was like really good, and then it was really stupid after the spaceship.
Yeah, I heard that a couple times, and I was really surprised because I stand completely by what I said last week. What did you think after you had some time to think on it?
What are you standing behind?
Well, last week I said that I felt like, you know, that while I wish they hadn't had Peggy and Ed acknowledge it, I still thought that them putting it in there, they had to do something. I mean, people would have been unhappy if they hadn't done something with spaceships, I think. And if only Peggy and Ed hadn't acknowledged it, and it could have just been something that Lou saw or whatever, then I think it would have been better for me. But I'm completely happy with the way they handled that. It was a little over I'm not completely happy, but I'm relatively happy. It was a little over the top, but I thought they tied in the whole spaceship UFO thing just enough. Well, a little too much, but at least they tied it in.
Well, some people didn't like the narrator either. Like, it was silly to have a narrator do the voiceover.
I loved it.
I thought the narrator, I think if you put the narrator and the spaceship together, it's a good combination. Because it's almost like a narrator telling a children's story or telling a fable, right? If think about sitting down around the Christmas tree and having somebody read The Night Before Christmas. You know, it's not a true story. You know it's not true, but a narrator embellishes it and makes it sound entertaining and interesting, and it makes you feel good, and you get the idea of the story from the narrator. It's not like a factual account. And I think having the narrator in the episode last week gave them the license to talk a little bit and embellish a little bit.
And that's if they hadn't called it a history book, then I would agree with you maybe a little more. But I still agree. I thought it was good with the narrator, too. I mean, I thought that with the spaceship tied in as well. So,
but that history book wasn't like on the 15th day at Dunkirk, 75 guys jumped a cliff to attack German outposts. I don't think it was that.
I thought it was.
I don't know. I don't think it was. I think it was more of a fable, that book.
Oh, okay. I thought it was a history book, like, you know.
Yeah, but it was a history book like true crime. True crime in the, you know, kind of embellished type story type of history.
Okay.
I don't know. It's open for interpretation, and so I guess you can like it or hate it, but I don't know. I just think the narrator, having a narrator gave it a little bit more freedom to be embellished, like that spaceship was so huge it covered the whole sky. I don't know.
But what did you think about last week?
I didn't really like the spaceship very much either, but the more I thought about it, the more I connected the narrator and the spaceship, and I kind of settled on it.
Sure.
But it was kind of a pretty strong curveball for this whole thing.
It was, but they've thrown us other curveballs. They just didn't show them to us. You know, we saw the end result of them, but they just didn't show us the curveball coming with Ry losing time and Hansi losing time and the guy at that gas station when Lou pulled in talking about, you know, spacecraft and being abducted and stuff like that. I mean, they hinted and hinted and hinted. Although in this episode with Hank at the end, I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, but showing it, thinking about it and showing it are two different things. Like
it is.
Thinking about, wow, I wonder why was that time jump? I wonder what, you know, just your imagination kind of writes its own story. So here, Michelle, I'll share something with people. I had my dog put to sleep today because he was really old and bad shape and was really, really super sad. And as I left, I kind of thought, I've always thought about people that died, like they know something that we don't know. Like now they know. They know what happens when you die. And I thought about that. I mean, my poor dog, he's probably in a better place. And now my voice is going to crack up. But
don't. You're going to make me cry.
But,
no.
But now he knows. So that's kind of my, I don't know. I don't know if this makes sense connected to what we just said, but that's a thought that I have now that I don't really know what happens when you die, but sometimes I think like people that die have they're one up on us, right? They know, now they know. They know what happens when you die. So not knowing is different than having it shown to you and having to think about it is almost more interesting than having it put right in front of you to see.
Oh, I agree with that. Absolutely.
So I don't know if that's a good analogy or not, but it's a way to work my dog into this podcast.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. So so let's begin this, Michelle. 12 minutes in, we haven't said a word about the episode yet.
Well, we've talked about more important things.
So. All right. Well, so this time Lou's voiceover is the narration. And Lou clarifies the deaths, all the deaths we've seen. Ry in the freezer, Otto on the kitchen table. Dodd, after he was shot, Simone, we now know about Simone for sure.
Yeah, we do.
Floyd and Bear. This is the totality of the whole Gerhardt family. Their demise was, like, complete.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, we saw them all.
Yeah, so, but Michelle, Betsy lives. You were right, I was wrong. Betsy lives. She's resting with Molly, with Noreen, Mother Henning over her, watching over them. And
yeah,
I guess
she barely lived, though. Did you see her? She looked terrible.
Yeah, but they try to just say she had a reaction to the pills.
Yeah, like the cancer medication caused that is kind of what I felt like they were trying to say.
But she looked pretty pale and bleak. And in fact, there's one part of this in my review as I was watching this, I typed in, I don't know if Betsy's going to make it through the end of this episode, because I still kind of thought that Lou might not make it home in time to see her halfway through.
Oh, I know. Yeah, she looked really bad when she woke up in bed beside Molly. And Noreen was sitting there. She looked really, really sick.
So, Michelle, were you sadder about all those Gerhardts dying or happier about Betsy being alive? What was more impactful?
Well, I feel bad. I feel bad for Betsy because we know Betsy's outcome because we've seen the future in season one. So it's hard to get really I mean, I was very glad she was there. I was very glad that Molly had that moment with her. I was glad Lou wasn't going to be gone on this case, which I felt like he would maybe spend the rest of his life kicking himself for or whatever. So I was really glad she was there. But we know her eventuality. So part of that is, you know, it's sad. It's so sad anyway. Of course, I guess you could say we know all of our eventualities, but I don't know. Part of that is just so sad. The Gerhardt stuff, I don't know. I didn't feel, you know, I mean, you just felt like it was expected, right? Because, I mean, with all the bad that they did and the people that they were fighting and this fight that they had literally just invited, I would have been surprised had it ended much
differently. Yeah, but they revealed their family side to us. They showed their warm-looking living room with the couches and the pictures and the, you know, it wasn't just a bunch of criminals. It was a family, too.
Oh, I
was
know.
Pretty sad about those Gerhardts, man. My dog Barkley's going to haunt this podcast because I'm thinking about that. But I think I was sadder about the Gerhardts than I was happy about Betsy, because we kind of know Betsy's going to die. But that whole family was wiped out. That whole family was just like that peaceful, maybe not peaceful, but that part of the time it had to be a happy home at some times, right? They're all gone now. They're all just gone.
Yeah, it's but crazy. Who were you sad about leaving?
Just the whole family being wiped, every one of them.
Yeah, but I have to stop and think, you know, which one.
Well, that's the problem. If you pick them out one by one, you're like, okay, Otto, he deserves it. Dodd, okay, he does. You know, you can easily, you can pick them off one at a time.
So when that's kind of what I was thinking. Yeah, that
when you think
made
about the
hard.
Family, it's harder. I don't know. Maybe
but
I'm
there
just...
was other people there too. Remember? I mean. There was, like, the younger grandkids, I think they said, that were upstairs asleep or something. Remember the people that were staying outside at the graves? And that,
I know, but now the whole place is a grave.
I know.
All right, well, Betsy asks, go back to Betsy. Betsy asks about Lou and her dad and finds out from Noreen that Molly wouldn't leave her side. Molly was just stuck there with her. Wouldn't go to her own bed. All right, and then Betsy narrates. So first we get Lou, and then we get Betsy. Pretty cool. And Betsy has this cool dream about the future.
Oh, I know. Did you love that? We got to see Molly, and we got to see Molly's baby, and we got to see Lou, old Lou, and Gus.
Oh, what about Nintendos and Walmarts?
Oh, I know. We got to see the little handle. Was that Nintendo?
I don't know. What is that?
It was some kind of little handheld game.
Game Boy or something. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what kind it was. But
and
cameras.
Yeah. Yeah, and big box stores and just all sorts of neat stuff.
So we saw the old crew again. Old Lou, Keith Carradine, Colin Hanks, Alison Tolman.
Mm-hmm.
And then the turmoil. But then she sees not just peaceful aging of people, but the turmoil of the future, the fracture of peace and enlightenment.
Yep.
It's not all magic. It's not all magical and filled with light. And she was worried at one point that it might never even come to pass, that what she was dreaming there might never actually happen.
Yep.
But it's good that we know it does. It's good that she was tuned into it because she never saw it.
Isn't that cool? Wouldn't that be cool if you really did, like, have some kind of premonition like that on your as you're slowly getting ready to transition out of the world?
But as she was seeing that, when she thought it might never come to pass, she saw the real evil look of Hansi kind of flash in there.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty cool. And then we jumped back to Hank and Lou from the last episode making plans for Sunday dinner when we weren't sure Hank was going to make it. And
yeah.
They didn't help us feel confident about that as they started playing Black Sabbath. Black Sabbath music.
Yeah. Yeah, Ozzy Osbourne. It's like, I don't know about this.
And Ed and Peggy running away from Hansi's scarred and blistered face from the tea or the hot water. All right, Michelle. So this episode had the most referred to Coen Brothers project was No Country for Old Men. It was all through this episode. From the station wagon guy stopping to help and then getting shot, that happened in No Country, to kind of prowling around on the streets with the brick buildings behind them. That's all No Country. And then Ed gets shot. So we go back to Mike and Kitchen. They arrive at the Gerhard's empty house. And this is where it kind of reminded me how cozy it looked. All the coats are there, but no people. No people are left. And that cool German coat of arms with the G and the hawk and the red.
Yeah.
Gerhard. Mike looks at the pictures on the mantle or the dresser and doesn't like one baby staring at him and turns it down.
I wonder who that was. Are we supposed to know who that baby was? It was a little,
little demon baby.
Unsettling. I wouldn't say that, but it was a little unsettling for sure.
Well, who was Mike's biggest nemesis?
Dodd?
Think so? I think it was Dodd. It looked old. Looked too old to be Dodd. Like maybe Otto.
Maybe Otto, yeah.
All right,
Otto was just so out of it by the time Mike Milligan got there that it doesn't feel like he was his arch emesis, but maybe.
Well, Otto looked at him and couldn't talk to him when he was kind of stroked out. And maybe he thought it was Otto looking at him
again. You're right. Oh, yeah, good point.
All right, so Ed and Peggy make it in their No Country for Old Men setting. They make it to the store and they send the clerk away and they try to hide as... Lou's chasing them, too. He's chasing both Hansi and them as Hansi's chasing them. And Lou crosses paths with Ben now, and Ben looks like kind of a coward that we know that he is.
Well, yeah, but he does explain what happened and that he was fighting those guys when Peggy attacked him, and that's actually the truth. I felt a little bit sorry for Ben in this episode. I mean, we all know how he is and everything, but he just seemed... vulnerable in this episode.
He was frantic. He was like, oh, what do we do? What are we gonna do? What are we gonna do? And Lou was just calm and cool.
Right.
So they strategize, and Lou kind of knows what to do. And remember, Lou was sent out of the state. You stay out of the state. This is for the big boys to handle, and he's the one that comes back and fixes everything.
Right.
All right, Michelle, so what is Hansi's plan here? What's he going to do? Why is he chasing these? Why does he need to finish these two off?
You know, I think it goes back to the story that we read in the book last week. Why? Why does he? What was his obsession with getting rid of Ed and Peggy? Was it just a job that he hadn't finished, or was it more personal because he felt like they had wronged him? I don't know.
I didn't like Hansi appearing so ruthless. I wanted to know his end game. He seems smarter. He seems so much wiser earlier. He's wiser than a murderer. He had philosophy, and I don't know. He seemed like he was correcting some justice that was done to his people, but just to murder people for the sake of murdering them. I mean, Ed and Peggy didn't do anything bad to any Indian people. I didn't like him so ruthless.
Yeah, I didn't either. That's a good point. I didn't really put that two and two together because, you know, we just watched this. It, like, literally just went off a few minutes before we started talking. And, but I didn't like him like that either. He seemed, before when he was doing what he did, it seemed like he was doing it because he was following orders. And then when he wasn't following orders anymore, it just seemed like what he did was more thoughtful. Even if it was bad stuff, it was stuff that he had put a lot of thought into, that there was a reason behind. And him chasing Ed and Peggy, I didn't really like that either. It didn't make any logical sense to me for him to want to kill them.
Yeah, the things he did before were more thoughtful. They were more profound. It seemed like it had some meaning behind it. I don't know. Maybe there's a meaning here that we just haven't caught yet. But
maybe.
So we are doing this a day early, Michelle. I wanted to talk to you because of Barkley today. So I felt like I'd feel better talking to you. Plus, I'm traveling tomorrow, but so maybe if you hear this early, that's kind of why, you know, it's early.
Aw, that's sweet.
But Ed and Peggy hide in the freezer and lock themselves in, and Ed says he doesn't think they'll make it. Even if they get out of this, we're just too different, Peggy. Pretty weird, profound thing for Ed to say.
Yeah, where did that come from?
Well, Ed's approaching death here, too. Maybe he's getting some deeper insight. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe so. Because I thought that was so out of character for Ed to say something like that to her. Particularly, I mean, you know, talk about a weird time to bring something up. I don't know. I just thought that was kind of out of character for Ed, and yeah, I was kind of surprised.
That's anti-palindrome for Ed. Ed's a simpleton, and now he's like a philosopher.
And he's right. Yeah. Yeah, he absolutely is. He's right about it, and he's making this sense, and he's like connecting these dots that he couldn't seem to connect before. So maybe you're right. Maybe this is like the whole, you know, time's coming to an end, and what am I seeing now?
So the palindrome, so maybe Sepinwall had nailed it, the people, the palindromes of people, because Peggy seems the same. She's still finding philosophy in this, that adversity heals the bond, like a bone that's broken is stronger at the point it breaks. And Ed just finally says, look, you try to fix everything even when it's not broken. And I just want to go back to what we had.
Yeah, that was a pretty profound thing to say, too. The you try to fix things even when they're not broken. And right. It kind of made her look over at him, and she was like, what? You know, but some of the stuff was resonating with her. The thing about Peggy was they made Peggy look more and more out of it as the season progressed. When it first came on, I didn't realize that she was really not mentally stable. And by the ends of it, particularly tonight, I mean, well, maybe not particularly, but certainly tonight, she just proved again. I mean, she is really not thinking clearly.
Well, Kirsten Dunst rocks this episode. She's really good in it. And she's really good in it later, too, when she's talking.
Yeah.
To Lou? I think it's to Lou.
Mm-hmm. But not just this episode. Thinking back on her the whole season, I just can't imagine that role having been played better. I thought she did a great job. I mean, I completely believe who she is.
But I think it was easier to play the person she was first on when she was kind of the ditzy, dopey.
Oh, sure.
Now it's harder, and she's really killing it in this episode.
Yeah.
All right, so in that store, the lights are flickering as Hansi's menacing around. That's pretty creepy.
Yeah, it was.
Do you think it was too menacing? Do you think they made him look too menacing? Because he had the scarred-up face, and he was, like, making the lights blink on and off. Was he too surreal?
Yeah. And then at the end, I wasn't even sure if he was ever actually there.
Well, let's try to figure it out. So that was the first commercial. And we come back to Mike in one of the kitchens. Now, he calls him by his first name, Gail.
Yes, he did.
Gail Kitchen.
Yep.
They meet the Indian woman, the cook in the kitchen, the Gerhardt's cook or Hansi's aunt or something, Wilma.
Yeah.
Indian woman cooking at the Gerhardt's. And Mike tastes the soup or whatever she's cooking and makes a crack about, let there be no more schnitzel or strudel, American food up in here from now on.
Yep.
And then Disco Buffalo arrives back. What's that guy's name?
Buffalo Ricky.
Ricky, yeah. So, Michelle, I found out in between episodes two during my goofing around on, I was going to say Netflix, on Reddit. There's a Buffalo, Minnesota. It's not New York.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a Buffalo near Fargo.
Oh, okay.
So that's where he's probably from, not from New York.
Okay. But that makes more sense. But he kind of reminds you of 70s New York, don't you think?
With his but Buffalo is as far from New York City as...
Sure.
Bakersfield is from Los Angeles. It's like... I'm sure it's not at all like New York City. But he's pretty happy. He's pleased with himself because he thinks he's alone in a candy store here coming back to the Gerhardt's place. He busts out his burglar bag and starts picking out the silver to rob the place.
Yeah. What is that all about? Okay, first of all, did he go with them and make it back? I'm trying to remember if I saw him.
Yeah, he bailed. He chickened out and ran away. When the shooting started, he hopped in a car and drove away.
Okay, I'd forgotten that scene.
Yeah.
So, I guess he didn't stay around, or did he stay around to see that everybody died?
Because no, I mean, he bailed the minute the shooting, the minute trouble started, he turned tail and ran.
But he would have to know. He would have to know that they're all, and he even says it, you know? He says they're all dead. He would have to know before he started looting that place. Because there's no way this guy would have looted thinking that somebody could come in.
Well, somebody did come in.
Well, good point.
So Kitchen catches him.
Yeah.
I can't force myself to call that guy Gale.
That don't seem, no, he's Kitchen.
Kitchen catches him, and then Mike friendos him, another No Country. No Country continues on and on, calls him friendo. And Disco says, I'm stealing the silver from Need. Let's just let bygones be bygones. Like, he needs the money. He needs it. So it's justified just because he needs it. And then Mike gets all philosophical on him. He describes sovereignty. Your king, absolute power and authority. And this is a pretty cool philosophical little exchange here between Disco and Mike.
Yeah, it was perfect, Mike Milligan.
Where he says, Disco says, we don't do kings in America. And Mike says, oh, yes, we do. And today's my coronation day. Kings start their day with kindness and cruelty. So their people know, like, they're
capable of
all of it. And Disco looks pretty relieved for a second, but then he says, Wilma received the kindness, and you know what that means, so Disco's going to get the cruelty.
Did you hear, because I thought I heard him say, I thought I heard Ricky ask him if he was Otto's kid with the maid.
Oh, did he?
Remind me who you are again, the kid Otto had with the maid or something.
Like to smart then, ass him?
I don't know. I don't know if he was thinking, well, no, because he would have known he wasn't Hansi. I don't know. I don't know what he was thinking.
Well, you wouldn't say that out of respect to anyone.
No, absolutely. But that was where Mike said, you see the shotgun, right? Or something like that.
Yeah, so Disco does receive the cruelty.
He does.
Before he gets blasted, though, he asks Mike about Baltimore. And then tries to draw on him, but he does a really shitty job of drawing his gun. Pulls it out from the back behind his back, and it took way too long.
Well, and, I mean, come on, he stood no chance against Kitchen with that big, what was it, shotgun?
Yep, Kitchen shoots him, and then the cruelty part of it—that wasn't even the cruelty. The cruelty part was letting him die slowly.
Yeah, Kitchen went over to finish him off, and Mike stopped him.
And then they're going to go take a nap because they're tired from their long day. They didn't do anything. They drove up to the fight, and the fight was like, okay, then they just turned around and left.
Well, maybe the adrenaline of the whole thing. But Mike can't wait to go in tomorrow and check in with the big guys. He thinks they might even throw a parade in his honor or something. He's pretty proud of himself.
He's going to receive the warm champagne of corporate praise.
Oh, geez. Yep.
And then we get a commercial. Well, Hansi's still hunting Ed and Peggy, and Peggy admits she's been troubled. So Peggy's coming to reaching realization that she has been troubled. She's not just all glad-handing him with phrases and stuff. She admits that she's been some trouble. And Hansi starts to smoke them out of that freezer. Man, that Hansi's smart.
that scared me to death.
Can't just hide in a freezer and lock him out. He's going to get you. Hansi.
And they were even showing, like, flame outside the door, right, with Hansi?
Yeah, he was doing something to make that smoke go in there. So Peggy remembers the movie, and they appear to be in the movie now. And the image of the movie appears in the smoke. At first, I thought that smoke was Hansi coming through the vent and, like, vaporizing himself into the freezer.
Oh, wow.
I did play it back a couple times, but it wasn't. It was just the image of the movie and the smoke. And the solution in the movie to get away was similar to the solution to the situation that Peggy and Ed are in now. And Peggy just remembers in the movie they were saved.
Right.
But nothing can save Ed, Michelle.
No, she goes over to tell him, and It's the end of that.
He's shot in the chest, like right by his heart, so he probably didn't have much of a chance.
Yeah, it looked like it might have been a little bit higher, but I mean, he obviously wasn't shot in the heart, I wouldn't think, and made that trek all the way down the city or whatever. But I don't know. I was more sad about Ed dying than I thought I would have been. That was pretty sad. I was hoping at that point still that he had just passed out, but.
Okay, so this was a weird part. So Peggy opens the door to Ben and Lou, and there's no smoke. There's no Hansi. So what the hell? What's the meaning?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. She is definitely not mentally okay. They haven't showed her this bad before. They've showed her out of it before. Remember talking to the guy from LifeSpring when it was really Dodd sitting there? They've showed her hallucinate and stuff like that, but this was pretty big.
So you think Ed was dead for a while she still thought he was alive, talking to him?
No, I don't necessarily think that. I think Ed was in there probably talking to her, but I mean, she hallucinated smoke. But then again, they kind of showed us the whole thing, too, with Hansi being right outside the door. That's what I said. I don't know if he was ever actually even in the supermarket or not. I don't think they... You know, I think maybe he even wasn't.
Well, they showed him in the aisle with his face all scarred up.
Yeah,
I think he was.
But they showed him outside the door, too, with flames around him. I don't think he would have left.
So where does he start and where does he stop? And where wasn't he and where was he?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I don't know. Because I don't think he would have just left and left Lou and Ben in there. I think he would have fought him if he had been in there. I could be wrong.
Well, we're going to see you in we're going to hear a little bit more from Hansi, I think. So, Michelle, Ben and Lou put her in the car, and we find out now that Hank's in the ICU, and it's optimistic that he'll be okay. And then Ben starts choking up and losing it, kind of, again, losing focus and not being very clinical about his law enforcement. And Lou is, again, really calmly confident, just tells him, you're going to be okay. Again, Lou's not even supposed to be there because he's been run out of the state. But he's running the show here and encouraging people that need help and helping, you know, Lou kind of saves the day here.
Yeah, Ben's pretty tore up over it. And Lou was really kind to him. And I really liked seeing that, especially considering how Ben was to Lou in the last episode, and that Lou got over that and continued. I remember he called him a girl in the last episode. And so, I don't know, I thought it was pretty big of Lou to be the way he was with Ben. It really showed us a lot about his character.
Yeah, he's taking the high road for sure.
Yeah.
So they make a point that they go right back over the Minnesota line to that phone booth.
Yeah.
So that reminds us that Lou at one point was not allowed back in, but he's there anyway. And then we get to the commercial.
Yep.
All right, Michelle, so we come back, and Noreen's still reading her Myth of Sisyphus book, and Betsy wakes up in the morning, and more philosophy. This philosophy was really, really smart and good in this. Noreen asks Betsy if she can feel the cancer, and Betsy says no, but she says no, not yet, and makes that peach analogy where one mm-hmm. side of the peach is fresh and firm and the other is kind of rotten.
Yeah.
Pretty creepy.
It was creepy, and it was kind of, I don't know, it was deep, kind, wasn't it? In a, I don't know, it really, it was certainly graphic, the way she was describing it.
So Noreen offers that Camus says, knowing we're going to die makes all of life absurd. And Betsy says, well, we're put on earth to do a job. We each get time to do it. And when that time's over, we can't tell the Lord it was some Frenchman's joke. It was all some Frenchman's joke. Pretty smart.
It is smart. And she calls Camus foolish. And she said, well, obviously this author didn't have a six-year-old. And it really is different takes as far as Noreen reads it and sees it one way because of her life experience, and of course, Betsy is looking at it completely differently.
So what do you think about that philosophy, Michelle?
That life is foolish?
Knowing that we're going to die makes life crazy.
I'm with Betsy on that.
Well, even Noreen, she made Ed help get those people out of the fire. Life's so foolish. She didn't just sit there and die. She wanted to save people and get out of that fire way back in the butcher shop.
Yeah, the desire to live is pretty strong. And, you know, I mean, people will really fight for life. And so I just think all that life is foolish. We all die anyway. I think that's just, you know, I'm with Betsy. I think it's nonsense.
All right, Michelle. Well, Peggy wants to know from Lou if she can serve her time in federal prison in San Francisco Bay so she can see pelicans.
Yeah, is she talking about Alcatraz? What is she thinking? She's wanting this to go federal so she can maybe be put in a prison?
Yeah, she wants to get out of Minnesota. She's not thinking about federal versus local jail. She's thinking about getting out of Minnesota.
That is... It's sad, and it's...
Michelle, do you want to relate your time in federal prison versus your time in jail?
That's a very private thing, Mike. We'll have to talk about that later.
All right, well, every time two people get together, we get philosophy, Michelle. So now Lou tosses in his two bits here about Saigon. At the end of the Vietnam War, the last 24 hours, how people had to get out. And they all got out on helicopters and flew those out to the sea to ships, landed on the ships, and then pushed the helicopters over the edge, over the deck.
Yeah, because there wasn't room for them.
And until the very end, when the big helicopters, the Chinooks, were too big to land on the ship, so they would hover over the deck, and people would jump out onto the deck. And then at one point, a baby was tossed out by a mother and caught by a sailor. It's pretty cool. And then the pilot, who had to figure out how to get himself on the deck, tipped the helicopter on its side and jumped out and survived.
Yeah, it was a crazy story.
So Peggy says, "What are you saying?" She doesn't get it. And Lou kind of says, "Well, your husband said he would protect his family, and now I understand that." It relates it to the Sisyphus thing, that the rock we all push is our privilege, not our burden. So his take on Sisyphus is that it's a privilege to be able to push that rock up the hill every day, even if it rolls back.
Yeah, wasn't that really something? This was one of the parts that I was going to say, the conversation between Lou and Peggy really felt like, I don't know, I really saw Lou being more old school than I had seen him maybe before. You know, the woman, man kind of differentiation. And, I mean, I was really young in the 70s, so it really might have been like that more than I remember. But, I don't know, the way he put it felt kind of, I don't know, it just felt like older thinking, and it was older thinking that I'm used to seeing Lou doing. But that was a great story he told her, and it was a really great thing. And when he said that that when Ed told him he was going to do whatever he had to do to protect his family no matter what, and he acted like he didn't understand, but he does understand, and he went into all that, I just thought that was great. Wasn't that a great scene?
Well, that's your take on, he's got your take on Camus, like the helicopter pilot, like the mother tossing a baby out the window to somebody hoping they'll catch the baby. That's a pretty last-ditch effort to reach and keep your life going, your baby's life going. And the pilot hovers and turns the helicopter sideways and jumps out. He wants more than anything to live, even if life's crazy and absurd, because we all know we're going to die. That's your take. That's your positive take on Camus. And I think that's what Lou's trying to say.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, yeah. He's agreeing with Betsy there.
Right, and he told Peggy this story as an example of, like, look at what some people do to live. They'll do anything to live. It's a privilege, even if it's a struggle, and it's our it's all our fate that we're all going to die at the end. It's not absurd. It's our privilege to be able to roll that rock up the hill.
So was that the palindrome? The up the hill and down the hill, and that it's all the same, it's all a privilege?
Yeah, maybe. Or I no. guess you could think about that. It's all, the situation is palindromic, like you do it all over again every day. I don't know.
I don't know. We just hear this Sisyphus again and again and again, it seems like, and I don't know.
Yeah, well, Sisyphus, I think, is a different theme than the palindrome. I don't know. Maybe it's not. Yeah. It's kind of circular, huh? You do the same thing every day. You know it's going to end up the same way, and yet you keep doing it. So Peggy says, I never meant for any of this to happen. I just wanted to be someone. I wanted to choose and not be defined by someone else. And then she kind of blames Rye, how Rye made her a victim.
Yeah. Yeah. Lou points out, he goes, you mean the victim, because she says that, she says, why did Rye have to walk out in front of my car? And that's where Lou says, you mean the victim? You know, I mean, Peggy's not going to take any responsibility for her part, I don't think.
Well, you didn't like it when she blamed Lou for chasing them into that, being on the run. It's kind of like blaming Rye it's kind of putting the blame on Rye, too. It's like blaming somebody who really doesn't deserve the blame.
Well, I mean, somebody in the middle of the road that gets hit, you can certainly see where she would get that. But it's not her hitting him, but it was her actions after she hit him that she didn't take any responsibility for. I don't know that we could blame her for actually running him over, but she didn't want to take any responsibility for any of it.
She's got some more philosophy to impart on us, Michelle. She says, you wouldn't understand because you're a man, and it's a lie that you can do it all, like being a mother, a wife, a career woman, 37 hours in a day. You just can't do this. And she really, this is where I said Kirsten Dunst kills this episode, because she really does act this out really, really well.
Yeah, and we finally get to see all of her fears. We see everything she was running from and running toward and why in that one little blurb that she does right there. She says, and when you can't do it all, you're the faulty one. You're inferior. So that was her fear the whole time.
Well, Lou brings it in for a landing and just says, people are dead, Peggy. You can philosophize all you want. People are dead.
And then her face kind of crumbled a little bit.
And then California Dreaming as they drive on. Bobby Womack version of California Dreaming, not the nice poppy Mamas and Papas one. And then it was a beautiful day, too. It was like a nice Minnesota day. It looked like a nice California-like day there.
Yeah.
Kind of odd. So this is where Lou gets to the phone booth. He calls Noreen and Betsy, and the Noreen and Betsy team, I guess, and Noreen tells him the news. And Michelle, I still thought at this point Lou might not see Betsy, like, oh, Betsy's okay, but then when he gets home, Betsy has passed away.
Yeah, I was a little bit worried about that here too.
But Lou thanks Noreen, and we get to a commercial.
And we also see, I'm sorry, just let me tell you one thing. Right here, we see Lou when he finds out that Betsy has fallen. Noreen just says she's fallen, and that the doctor came, and she's going to go into the doctor next week for tests, and she goes through all that with Lou. But Lou is visibly shaken, and when he hangs up the phone, he does like this little mini collapse. He kind of, you know, falls forward a little bit, or slumps forward into the phone booth, and you can really see the first time we've seen Lou be that scared and that vulnerable.
You don't think any of that was relief? Like, oh, I'm glad she's not passed away, because he couldn't reach her before.
Maybe it might have been relief, but either way, it was his vulnerable side. Whether he was scared what had happened to her that he wasn't aware of, or whether it was relief that they were there and everything was okay, you could just see his tough exterior kind of crack for just a moment. And I liked seeing that with Lou.
You did?
I liked seeing just that little piece of it. Just for the second, we got to see that, how much Lou does care. And we've known he cares, And you don't need to see, like, great images of his caring, I don't think. But just that little crack of it was, it was perfect. I love seeing that.
All right, Michelle, we got in a commercial. We come back from the commercial, and these boys are playing catch on the ball field. Now, you tell me what you think we got going here.
What, with the kids playing catch or with Hansie? Or with, I just thought there was two kids playing catch and then some other kids came up. Is that what you're talking about?
When the two kids playing catch, two deaf kids.
Right.
It's little wrench in numbers. They're connecting the two freaking seasons. That's got to be little wrench in numbers, right?
Oh, my gosh. I did not connect that. That had to have been.
They get picked on by two bullies and Hansie in the stands kind of watching them. And Hansie and his conversation with that man. This was another two people together philosophy. Mm-hmm. Just left and right, man. This is so well written. This episode was my favorite one. But I think that's wrench in numbers playing catch and they get picked on by some bullies.
Oh, that's brilliant.
But a man walks up and talks to Hansie. Now, I don't even know if we know this guy's name. Or
no, I don't think so.
Or know it. But it talks about great empires fall and are forgotten. And that's... That reminded me of Ozymandias, of course, Breaking Bad, and like fallen kings, kings of everything, and eventually they all crumble and fall, and great men become dust, and that was pretty cool. This is like a total tribute show, total tribute to all these great, great periods of television. But he's there to give Hansie his new wallet, and his new ID is Moses Tripoli. And then a man tells him that Tripoli, the Tripoli in Libya, the one founded by the Phoenicians and then conquered by Romans, Spanish, and Turks. And then we see the boys, the deaf boys, send each other hand signs. And Hansie asks if there's a face man so he can get his face fixed. And this is more of Hansie wanting to be a new man and leave his old life behind.
Yeah.
All right, and the man says, like Phoenix Rising, to join a new empire. And Hansie says, or maybe start one of my own.
Right.
Now, Michelle, I saw this somewhere in between our brief time between my ending of watching the show and our podcast that the head of the Fargo mob was named Mr. Tripoli in season one.
So Okay.
Hansie may have gotten his face really jacked into a new configuration, and he's the Mr. Tripoli that was connected to the Fargo mob in season one.
Did we ever see him?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Okay. I don't either. Okay.
But Hansie does say, you know, earlier in this season, he's sick of this life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
He's the type of guy that could rise to the top of a criminal empire, I think.
Okay. Was this guy the guy? Did he pay Hansie to do off with the Gerhards? Is that what that was about? Or was this somebody that Hansie had just commissioned to get him a new identity?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I think the Tripoli guy was the guy that was shot by Lorne Malvo in the first season.
Which one?
The guy that Mr. Tripoli that Hansie.
Right, but which guy that was shot? Do you remember the scene?
I think Lorne Malvo at some point shoots the head guy of the Fargo mob, and I think it's Mr. Tripoli.
Wow. Okay. Now I'm going to want to go back and find that.
So anyway, this is a larger scale Sisyphus, like a phoenix rising to join a new empire. And then as they talk about great empires fall and are forgotten. So this is like, and the man says, so when Hansie says to maybe start my own empire, and the man says, so it too may collapse. This is just Sisyphus again, right? Big empire takes 1,000 years to reach greatness and then it crumbles. And it happens over and over.
Well, and it's like you just said, the king's crumbling. Maybe that would be Mike Milligan crumbling, too. Because remember, he just compared himself to a king.
Yeah. Yeah, any king. Any king's going to crumble. Any kingdom is going to crumble. Any country in time will reach pinnacle and then the bottom. But the man asks, will you take revenge on Kansas City, apprehend them or bring them to justice or something? And Hanzi says, not apprehend them, kill them, no matter how heavily guarded, heads in bags or head in a bag.
Yep.
And then as the deaf boys fight the older bullies, Hanzi says something in Indian dialect, some sort of Indian phrase that means there's the message. He says that's what the caption was anyway. I don't know what he
said. Yeah, I don't either.
But he pulls out his knife and walks towards the boys that are fighting.
I know. Yeah, for these young kids out on the ball field, he pulls out. He's like going for his weapon as he goes out there. I thought they better run.
So the next scene is the Kansas City buildings. That was the building Lorne Malvo went in and killed everybody through the windows. Remember that building we saw from the street and we just saw?
I do.
That was that building. So that's Kansas City where Mike's stationed now, and that's where Lorne Malvo goes and kicks
ass. Wow. Okay. I did not know that.
So Mike and his big boss is Adam Arkin. And he was the director of this episode, by the way.
Oh, really? That's cool.
And Mike says, I worked hard and I got the job done. And Adam Arkin, I don't even know his name. He's probably got a name in here.
Probably yeah, I don't know. I didn't get it.
But he describes the roles he needs that Mike, and Mike needs to climb several more rungs before he can reach the pinnacle. And Michelle, he's got a 9-to-5 office job.
Yeah, they've taken this like mobster mentality that Mike's been working with this whole time and turned it into an office job, right?
So we've seen all these tributes to all the Coens, all the No Country for Old Men, and probably Breaking Bad's Ozymandias. And this was a direct tribute to The Shield. Did you see The Shield, Michelle?
I did. It's
the very last episode when Vic got stuck in the office job.
Yep.
This was it. This was it. You know, this guy, Noah Hawley, probably watched all these shows and probably loved those shows.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Mike's stuck in the 9-to-5 office jobs, optimizing revenue with the accounting department. He can't wear any Western clothing. He has to cut his hair.
Well, the 70s are almost over, Mike.
You want the old days? Go work in a coal mine. The only business left is the money business. I mean, Mike pushes back a little bit. He says, but I'm an earner. Let me out. Let me do my job. And the boss says, well, profit and loss is the game. Some guy saved $1 million in postage, and he got a big promotion. They gave him all of California. Your paperwork's on the way. We expect big things from you.
Oh, I know. And they're talking about, didn't they say something about filling out HR paperwork or something? Yeah. HR paperwork? How funny is that? I mean,
you play golf? Picture Mike Milligan playing golf.
Well, I can actually picture Mike Milligan being pretty adaptive to whatever situation he's put in, but the guy really went from being a gangster to a desk jockey pretty quick, didn't he?
His cubicle-sized office was comically small, too.
So tiny in that window, and he looks confused and vaguely unhappy.
Yeah, he looked just like Vic Mackey. Also, the giant typewriter, the giant electric typewriter that got him started in all this mess on his desk.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right, then we go to a commercial. We're almost to the end here, Michelle. Lou and Hank see Betsy now, and Molly runs up and hugs her grandpa Hank, and Noreen is there. Noreen's running that place now with Betsy kind of down for the count. And Hank, Lou, and Betsy talk, and Hank asks about the spacecraft. I think Lou was going to leave it out totally. Lou wasn't going to talk about it at all. And then they kind of relate to us that Hanzi's made the FBI most wanted list. He's probably escaped up to Canada.
Yep.
Betsy struggles a little bit with a cramp or something.
Yeah, she's visibly uncomfortable.
She makes a joke about all of their sad health.
Yeah, they're a sad bunch. And then what's Lou's sciatica is going to come on or something. I mean,
what's this thing about Hank saying, you know, the angels when they come because they have the faces of your children? That almost sounds creepy. Like you see your children coming, you know, you're going to die.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, that was a Yeah, I know he did. Yeah, he said, a man once said, you'll know the angels when they come because they will have the faces of your children. It's like, wow, okay. Or maybe he was just calling children angels.
And I how think much you know the loved. Angels when they come means you know when you're dying.
Maybe.
That's when the angels come, right? All right, well, Betsy tells Hank she knows about his office when she took care of his cats. She saw his room with the office. So what's up with that, Hank, baby? So Hank tells the story. Now we get a three-way philosophy here. So Hank says, after your mother died, I felt low. So Hank, what happened to Hank is about to happen to Lou. That he lost his wife
and raised Betsy. Ooh, that's a good point. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he says, after your mother died, I felt low, took some time off, and realized that all the stuff he saw in war and on the job, all the senselessness and violence was based by bad communication. Words we say and words we hear are not the same oftentimes. And so what about a universal language so everybody understands better? It's like you draw a heart, you know what it means. You draw a home, you know what it means. Love, it's all easy to understand.
There was something really endearing about that. It was so overly simplistic, and I was really waiting on it to be something about the aliens and the spacecraft, and I was waiting on him to tell some story, some insight that he had. But I kind of like that.
Yeah, they don't illustrate much about the spacecraft. Hank asks about it, but Lou, you know, Lou's pretty much like, oh, I don't have much to say.
And Betsy didn't even question it.
Right.
So, I mean, have they talked about it, you think? Or, I mean, we don't know. Or if it's just something that's common knowledge. I don't know. That was weird. You're right.
Or Betsy just accepts that some things Lou doesn't talk about, that she's not going to get him to talk about it.
Sure.
Like maybe stuff in Vietnam. She just knows it. She just knows her man. But she tells Hank, you're a good man. Tells her father, you're a good man. And Hank says, I got good intentions. And then as he's saying that, Lou puts away the book, The Great Brain by John Fitzgerald. Did you have those books, Michelle? Do you know what they are?
I didn't have those books, no.
I looked them up. It's a series of books for children ages 8 to 12. So obviously Lou's reading to Molly. And it's The Great Brain, More Adventures of the Great Brain. Me and My Little Brain, the great Brain Reforms, The Return of the Great Brain. So it's like a children's story that pretty cool. Lou's reading that to Molly. He tells Molly, tomorrow we're going fishing.
And she's all happy. That was pretty sweet.
So did you like the ending, Michelle? They say goodnight, Mr. and Mrs. Salverson, and they kind of fall asleep.
Yeah, I did like that. I thought it was enough, you know, and I had to look that up because they say, good night, Mr. Salverson, good night, Mrs. Salverson. And then he says, and all the ships at sea. And I think he said that before, right? So
yeah.
I'll look that up, and it's from an old radio show, Hello, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the ships at sea. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah, it's probably something that they remembered from their time, and they affectionately say it to each other. I don't know. To me, though, it seemed kind of anticlimactic. I guess we knew everything we needed to know. But
yeah, I mean, obviously, the penultimate episode was the one with the big bang, as we've seen them do in many TV series lately. The episode before the last has all the action, and then the last one can kind of, I don't know, soothe you down, calm you down, fill in the blanks, tie up everything, dot the I's and cross T's. And I really liked how they did that. And I liked how they did that and reconnected it like to the first episode all over again when that was going on at the beginning. The good night, Mr. Salverson, good night, Mrs. Salverson.
Well, Michelle, someone might call that a palindrome, connecting the beginning to the ending.
Someone might.
All right, well, that's about it for, I guess I'm on a day like this, for me, it's a good to end in a happy little scene like that. So that was a good way to end. So what did you think of this season overall, Michelle, for Fargo season 2?
I'm telling you, I thought it was, I liked it better. I liked season one because who doesn't love Billy Bob Thornton? But I gotta tell you, I thought this episode was so much deeper, and I just think Noah Hawley outdid himself. I cannot imagine, there's very little TV ever on air that's better than this TV that we're watching right now.
All right, Michelle, and this is renewed for season three.
I know. I'm so excited.
Hopefully Noah Hawley will continue to get better, because I think this was better than season one.
What did we hear about season three? It's going to be something set. I heard something.
After
I can't remember.
Season one, time-wise. So right. More recent than season
one. More current.
One.
Right.
All right, Michelle, that's it for Fargo season two. Ending of episode 10, the whole thing. So we'll see you next year for Fargo 2016.
Okay. We'll see you then.